Hillary Clinton is supposed to be the feminist choice for president. But is Hillary's feminism actually good for women?
When we look at Hillary's record, we see a record of supporting welfare reform, which meant changing welfare policy so that many, many poor women got thrown into much deeper poverty. We see a record of not only voting for the Iraq War as senator, but going on as Secretary of State to pursue very interventionist, aggressive policies that in many cases led to more war, more rape and femicide. These are not feminist policies. And a feminism that embraces these policies is really a feminism for a few, but not a feminism that is going to benefit the majority of the world's women.
That's Liza Featherstone. We talk with her about the collection of essays she's edited, False Choices, the Faux Feminism of Hillary Rodham Clinton. Then we talk with one of the contributors to False Choices, Rutgers history professor Donna Murch. Her essay is titled, The Clinton's War on Drugs, When Black Lives Didn't Matter. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us on this station and on writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. There's a controversy playing out among the feminist community around the candidacy of Hillary Rodham Clinton. Hillary could be our first woman president, and some feminists are saying it's too good a chance to pass up. For them, that Hillary is a woman is what makes her the best choice for president. But other feminists criticize her record in pushing for policies they say have hurt women, especially poor and middle-class women. They're hoping for a woman candidate in a future election who more closely represents their values. My guest, Liza Featherstone, is the editor of a forthcoming book of essays written by the second kind of feminist. They take up such issues as welfare reform, mass incarceration and the war on drugs, military intervention, and economic policies that favor big banks and corporations, to argue that voting for Hillary Clinton is a false choice for feminists. And they question whether the Democratic Party's record on protecting reproductive rights is actually good enough to ignore Clinton's other policies and vote for her. Liza Featherstone teaches journalism at NYU and at Columbia School of International Public Affairs. She writes for The Nation and Slate, among other venues. False Choices will be published in June by Verso Press, but you can find excerpts online by going to writersvoice.net. Liza Featherstone, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much.
This book, False Choices, the Faux Feminism of Hillary Clinton, starts out with a little play in one act that's written by Laura Flanders, the media person. It's a discussion between her and her partner about Hillary. Mm-hmm. Her partner is a Hillary supporter. She has grave questions about Hillary. This is an issue that's actually playing out between, I think, a lot of women and a lot of women friends, partners or not. Feminists who find themselves on the opposite side of the fence. I wonder if you could just illuminate this issue of the fence that divides so many women who see themselves as feminists.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I really love that sketch that you mentioned, and that's why we opened the book with it, because I think that it does give us such a window into the arguments on both feminist sides of the Hillary question, as well as being a fun little look at one couple's relationship. And I think that that for a long time, and this issue is bigger than Hillary, a number of us, those of us who are feminists on the left, have been frustrated by the way feminism is always in recent years framed as elite feminism, and that feminism is worse than that. We're often seeing neoliberalism, like anti-worker policies, anti-poor people policies, very belligerent, warlike policies, being repackaged as feminism. And I think that a lot of people don't realize that left feminism is a real tradition and that it's actually really active and lively right now in particular. I mean, I have been observing and not particularly liking Hillary Clinton for years, but it wasn't so much out of a seething rage at Hillary that I put this book together, but more that I realized, oh, this campaign is going to be a cultural and political event in which we are going to see something that I think is actually quite conservative being packaged as feminism, and we could be really mad and sad about that, or we could use it as a chance to elevate left feminist voices and left feminist arguments. So that was what we decided to do.
Well, it's a wonderful collection and has some leading lights in it, including Frances Fox Piven and Medea Benjamin, and also some people who may be less well known, but really, really interesting in how they went into depth about things. How do Hillary supporters construct feminism? And why do you call it false feminism?
So it's a little mean of us to call it faux feminism. And by that, I should say, I don't mean to say that I don't think that Hillary is a feminist. You know, anyone who calls herself a feminist is a feminist. But I do think that the feminism that rallying behind Hillary represents is a dead end for women, a dead end for the majority of women. And the reason that I say that is that when we look at Hillary's record, we see a record of supporting welfare reform, which meant changing welfare policy so that many, many poor women got thrown into much deeper poverty. We see a record of not only voting for the Iraq War, but going on as senator, but going on as Secretary of State to pursue very interventionist, aggressive policies that in many cases led to more war, more rape and femicide. These are not feminist policies. And, you know, beyond Hillary herself, a feminism that embraces these policies is really a feminism for a few, but not a feminism that is going to benefit the majority of the world's women. So faux feminism is really a shorthand for saying we think this is a dead end.
So in other words, you're saying you don't deny her the label of feminist because she identifies that way, but you're saying her policies are ones that don't promote the needs of women.
Right, exactly. Her policies are not feminist policies. Her record is not a feminist record. I do certainly believe she's sincere in her feelings that she is a feminist.
You also go a little bit beyond that by saying that her campaign is actually using feminism as a cudgel against, quote, any sort of left politics which might actually help women. So unpack that statement for us.
Yeah, and that's something that is really very deeply troubling, the way that I think we're seeing the Hillary Clinton campaign deploy feminism to attack the left. So we're seeing Bernie Sanders supporters, although a great many of us are women, something that is shown by polls and by voting and by attendance at rallies and knocking on doors and every other way. But supporters of Bernie Sanders have been labeled as Bernie bros, you know, and this sort of caricature that these are all sexist men who are like lurking around on Reddit hating women. And we've seen this sort of the rhetoric that women who are supporting Bernie Sanders instead of Hillary Clinton, that there is something suspect in their feminism. Debbie Wasserman Schultz insinuated that young women were taking feminist gains for granted, and you know that they weren't sufficiently concerned about reproductive rights. And you know, so we're seeing this sort of feminist criticisms of the left, which really elides the way that left concerns and feminist concerns are for some of us not separable. I mean, many of us feel that you don't have meaningful reproductive rights in a society where everyone is not guaranteed health care as a right. Or, you know, as Maureen Sakacic argues in her very provocative piece about Hillary and abortion, is it really meaningful to talk about reproductive choice when so many young people don't even have the economic security to consider having a child? In what economic context are these choices taking place? And we see that study after study shows that union membership greatly reduces sex discrimination in the workplace. We don't see that as a prominent argument coming from the Hillary campaign or from Bernie's campaign, you know, either, by the way. So for many of us, these concerns about economics, as Hillary eloquently labeled Bernie's single issue, that those issues are somehow separate from feminist concerns. Many of us just don't really see that and are trying to say, actually, those things are quite intertwined.
It's very analogous to the way Hillary has been using race in the campaign. So I wonder if you can comment on that.
Yeah. Other commentators have been a lot more eloquent than I could be about the way that Hillary and other neoliberal candidates use race as a weapon against the left. But I think we've certainly seen that in the way that Hillary and her supporters constantly point out that Bernie Sanders has been more popular in white states.
Like Hawaii.
Right. I mean, like Hawaii. I mean, many inconvenient facts are glossed over in this rhetoric. But the insinuation always is that socialism or left politics is somehow irrelevant to black people. Most black people don't think so. I mean, most African Americans are very concerned with high rates of joblessness among black men, which actually Bernie Sanders has talked quite a bit about. And of course, with the mass incarceration policies that Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton actively contributed to. But I think that Walter Ben Michaels and others have, and Adolf Reed certainly, have written a lot about the way that anti-racism or multiculturalism has become an effective rhetoric for the neoliberal order, that if it can be made to look inclusive, we have some black people in power, we have some Latinos in power, that then a very unequal order that works mostly for the 1% looks more legitimate, it looks more inclusive. And I think that Hillary's rhetoric on race and trying to paint the Sanders campaign as racist or not inclusive is very much in that tradition.
Well, it's so ironic in a way, because one of the essays in the book talk about how the whole policy of mass incarceration that was pushed by Bill Clinton, and I think we have to be clear here also, Hillary was one of the main proponents of it in his administration. So it isn't as if, well, it was his policy and
yes,
we can't say anything about her.
Yes.
The article in this wonderful collection, False Choices, The Faux Feminism of Hillary Rodham Clinton, which you, Liza F. Featherstone, have edited, talks about how the adoption of this tough-on-crime policy was precisely to get the male white vote mm-hmm. back to the Democrats after it was bleeding after the Civil Rights Act.
Exactly. So Donna Murch, in her chapter, does a wonderful job with that history. And yeah, exactly right, that these policies of being tougher on crime and incredibly long sentences, these policies that so increased the incarceration rate of our citizenry, that they were all about pandering to the angry white men and women. And you know, it was an effort to court the so-called Reagan Democrats back into the fold. You know, this is a very ugly history. And I think that it's interesting that people don't remember that, and that now the Clintons are so easily cast as being the party of anti-racism and inclusion. I think that to some extent, this is a failing of the left, that we have always needed to do a better job of building really cross-racial, cross-class movements. And I think when that happens, we are so much less vulnerable to this kind of doublespeak. You know, and I think that people would be much more skeptical of Hillary Clinton's rewriting her history in this way if we were really presenting a much more united, multiracial coalition on the left.
So why is mass incarceration a feminist issue?
Good question. Donna Murch, who wrote about incarceration, and Yasmin Nair, who wrote about it as well, also for False Choices. Actually, a lot of women have been deeply affected by mass incarceration, not only by having all the men in their lives locked up, which is really deep.
And increased poverty.
Yeah, and greatly increased poverty. And that women are in many cases left to pick up after the devastation in their communities. So even using the frame that feminism is anything that affects women, it's certainly relevant there. We also felt that it was a feminist issue because women are increasingly, as nonviolent drug offenses started to be prosecuted much more aggressively, that increased the incarceration rate of women themselves. So it was relevant as a feminist issue in that way as well.
In fact, I think the book shows that it's skyrocketed by several 100%.
I think that's right, yeah.
But I wanted to actually go back to abortion, because there's an essay in the book, False Choices, called Abortion and the Politics of Failure, mm-hmm. that says that abortion is the Democrats' unique selling point to women. So what do you mean by abortion and the politics of failure, and how does Hillary Clinton fit in here?
I love that essay, by the way, by Maureen Sakasic, who's an incredibly talented writer and someone I've admired a long time. So I was thrilled she wanted to write a chapter for the book. And actually, that argument is something I myself have been thinking a long time and just really never managed to put into words and write down. So it really resonated to me. The argument that Maureen is making in that essay is that this sort of threat that Republicans are going to take away abortion has been one of the Democrats' main selling points to women in national elections, sometimes almost the only one, that, you know, vote for the Democrats because Republican war on women, which is always code for abortion. And, you know, they are going to take away abortion. And we actually do. We tend to pay attention to that. I mean, you know, because who wants to have abortion taken away? It's a very important right. You know, so we do, and we dutifully turn out and vote for whatever horrible person they put up. And so naturally, this argument and this specter has been especially intense with Hillary Clinton running because she is a woman. So the prospect of you can either vote for the first woman president or you can vote for people who are definitely going to take away abortion. So the vote for Hillary Clinton because abortion, it makes their usual argument, the usual Democrat argument, even more, you know, vociferous. What's wrong with this argument, as Mo argues, is a number of things. One problem with it is that the Democrats have been so reactionary for women in so many other ways that deeply affect us as women and even touch upon our reproductive rights. So you have Hillary Clinton's long history of cooperating and championing ending the social safety net for poor women. So, you know, it raises the question, whose war on women are we concerned about? You know, I mean, like, who is it who's launching a war on women? So there's that. And the abortion issue serves as a cover-up, you know, or a smokescreen for that.
Well, one of the most interesting points that I took away from this chapter in Faux Feminism by Maureen Sakacic is that the Democratic Party, this may be their major selling point, but they've been actually quite poor at, in fact, preserving and protecting the right of choice of women.
Yes. And this is one of the most important arguments of Maureen's chapter is not only is abortion only one of many issues that women might be concerned about, but this single-minded focus on abortion has not even helped us to preserve the right to abortion. There are fewer places you can get an abortion, and access to abortion has declined since the years of Roe v. Wade. So for the pro-Hillary forces like Debbie Wasserman Schultz to be getting so self-righteous about how young people don't appreciate the importance of the right of abortion, well, who is it that doesn't understand this importance? I mean, it's just a rhetorical thing to them. The actual reality is that access to abortion is shrinking.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Liza Featherstone. She's edited a new collection of essays called False Choices, The Faux Feminism of Hillary Rodham Clinton. It's forthcoming. The publication date is in June. Let's talk a little bit about education, because I think this is an area that I don't see a lot of press about in terms of Hillary Clinton and her positions. In one of the essays in the book talks about the Hillary Clinton and education reform, the whole push towards accountability, high-stakes testing, privatization of education. So I wonder if you could touch on some of those issues that are brought out.
Mm-hmm. So there's an excellent chapter in the book by Megan Erickson Kilpatrick, who's a public school teacher and a writer. And she writes about Hillary Clinton's history as a major player in education, so-called education reform, by which we mean the war on teachers and the championing of standardized testing. And this goes back to when Hillary Clinton was First Lady of Arkansas and Bill Clinton was governor of Arkansas. And they were viewed as a total team on this issue. They were referred to as Billary. And she was considered to be one of Bill's main advisors on the issue. And what they did was they figured out how to increase the accountability, meaning to tie teachers' firing and pay to the outcome of standardized tests in Arkansas. This resulted in, as it has subsequently everywhere else, an atmosphere of fear and repression among teachers.
Disproportionately black and women.
Yes, disproportionately black and women. Exactly. So this has really been like a war on a large group of middle class women workers. And I think it's really important to see education reform that way. It is a feminist issue, not only because women and children, though it's true that, as a mom, I'm much more engaged in these issues than I was before I had a child. But it is also a feminist issue because the workers in the schools are primarily women. So the Clintons did, they did their polling and their research. How hard should we make the test we are giving to the teachers? You know, how many teachers would it be acceptable to fire? And they thought a lot about this, and they really began that rhetoric of pitting students' interests against the teachers, of viewing teachers as the main problem in the school, as opposed to lack of funding, and as opposed to lack of resources in the communities from which the children come. Study after study shows that problems in schools are linked to the poverty of the students and the lack of resources of the schools. And we have been in a decades-long regime of policymakers viewing the problems as being with the teachers themselves. And the Clintons really started that. And it's a deeply anti-feminist and often racist agenda.
Mm. I used to teach in a for-profit school, and most of the people were poor women of color who would graduate with debts of like $21,000 after, you know, 18-month education. And they got a good education, but I think, you know, they just graduated with huge amounts of debt. So this is another education issue, is for-profit universities. And one of the essays in the book by Tressie McMillan Cottam, the essay is called The Great Ambivalence, goes into the connections between the Clinton Foundation and for-profit universities.
So Tressie is a real authority in this area of for-profit education, and she shows that there were very close financial ties between Laureate University, a for-profit university, and the Clinton Foundation, and that Bill Clinton was prominently displayed on Laureate's board, giving that company a lot of legitimacy at a time that that sector has been under much criticism and, you know, has been poised for a lot more government regulation. It's pretty troubling. And as Tressie argues, the students at for-profit universities are very often disproportionately Black and disproportionately women. So this is very much an issue that should concern us as feminists. And I'd add one that that I don't see Hillary getting asked about very much.
Liza Featherstone. We're talking about the forthcoming book she edited, False Choices, The Faux Feminism of Hillary Rodham Clinton. We'll talk more after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Liza Featherstone about how to judge Hillary Clinton's candidacy for president from a feminist perspective. Would a Hillary Clinton presidency represent an advance for women, or have her record and past policies done more harm than good, especially for poor and middle-class women? Featherstone has edited a forthcoming collection of essays, False Choices, The Faux Feminism of Hillary Rodham Clinton. One contributor is peace activist Medea Benjamin. Her essay is about Clinton's record on military intervention. One issue Medea Benjamin touches on, and that I asked Featherstone about, is the evidence of a pay-to-play system that Clinton may have set up as Secretary of State, arranging arms deals for U.S. corporations with foreign governments like Saudi Arabia and Azerbaijan. Then those corporations contributed to the Clinton Family Foundation or the super PAC supporting her campaign.
The connections of the Clinton Foundation and the sense of quid pro quo with foreign leaders while she was Secretary of State, it seems so clear when you look at those records that foreign leaders were often paying for access to the Secretary of State, and that companies were paying for access to the Secretary of State, that you'll see companies making donations to the Clinton Foundation, and then you'll see the strangely a policy or a deal goes through in Azerbaijan or somewhere benefiting that country. And I think that what people who are a lot more knowledgeable about those relationships than I have largely concluded that these relationships are legal, but that they are not okay. And it is still something that we as citizens should be very concerned about. In terms of the feminism of it, we really have seen it as part of the way in which she is so deeply intertwined with a very belligerent imperialist relationship to the world that I think a robust tradition of feminism would resist.
Yeah, in fact, Medea Benjamin points out that she has actually been called a neoconservative, that she is to the right of Obama. But back to this point of her hawkishness, I think that's what says so many people quite worried about her. What is the most important point of that to you?
I think that, well, she gets a lot of criticism, rightly so, from progressives for voting for the Iraq War, and I think that that's very important. But I think that the issues that you're bringing up, that she was within the Obama administration, always a voice considerably to the right of the rest of the Obama administration, who are not a bunch of, you know, hippie peaceniks like myself. I mean, like, they're really, like, you know, pretty establishment figures. But, you know, even the Secretary Gates and, you know, people like that, she was always a voice more ready to go to war, more ready to take an aggressive intervention. And I think that Medea's chapter is an excellent source on that, on, you know, the very misguided intervention in Libya. You know, the Republicans made such a big fuss about Benghazi, but the real, as Medea points out in her essay, the real problem there is not a couple days surrounding Benghazi. The real problem was the whole project of going in there and intervening in this country, and what a disaster it has been, not just for a couple Americans who lost their lives in Benghazi, though of course that's tragic, but the Libyans who have lost their lives and continue to be living with this very violent situation. I think along those same lines, that what should also get a lot more attention is Hillary's role in the undemocratic coup in Honduras. That as Secretary of State, she gave cover to and behind-the-scenes assistance to a right-wing coup against the democratically elected leader in Honduras that has left that country not only with its democracy in pieces, but has left that country a violent disaster. I mean, with, as usually happens when a country becomes more violent, greatly increased rates of rape and femicide, as Belén Fernández writes about eloquently in her chapter on this, which is, again, one of the really strong chapters in the book. I would highly recommend it.
And not to speak of the assassination of the great environmental leader, Berta Cáceres.
Yes, yes, which has happened more recently, and who had actually identified Hillary Clinton as a major person who had caused all these recent problems in her country. You know, I think that Hillary Clinton should be much more accountable for that than she is. I was interested, too, in the, you know, that I think some of the Democratic debates have been wonderful. It's really been great to see people actually talking about issues in a Democratic debate. And I think that Sanders has really been, you know, just having somebody who's so articulate raising these questions from the left has been terrific. I've been a little bit surprised that nobody has really been asking her in these debates about immigration, that nobody has really been asking her about Honduras. Like, why do you think all these people have to be coming here from Honduras? Why are kids coming here fleeing gang violence from Honduras? Because of Hillary Clinton's policies, because of Hillary Clinton's role in this coup and in unleashing all this violence in this country. And I've been kind of surprised that that hasn't been more prominent. And as usual, I think it's a sign that Belén's work needs to get out there more.
In fact, I mean, I think for our listeners who might say, well, what, you know, what could she have done? This was a coup by another government. I remember when that coup happened, many people were waiting for the United States to come in and say this is a military coup, and the U.S. could have played a very strong role in bringing back the elected president, which they did not do. And it seemed for a few days that that might happen, and then it didn't. And I think, you know, what has been uncovered is Hillary's role in preventing that from happening. Mm-hmm. So finally, many women say, when I talk to women about Hillary Clinton who are supporting her, what they say is they want her to be in government, A, because she would be the first woman president, but also because she's so experienced and so effective. How do you deal with those arguments?
One of the things that bewilders me about that argument is, you know, experience is sort of a strange thing. I mean, do you really want someone experienced in doing things that you think are terrible? I mean, you know, that's, it's sort of like, I'm always surprised by that. People say, oh, but, you know, she has so much experience in foreign policy, for example. Well, what other field of expertise do we say, you know, you had this job and a lot of people's lives were in your hands and they died. And in what other field would we say that that was a credential and a sign that you had so much experience? I mean, like if you were a doctor or a pilot, you know, this would really be bad news. You know,
20 years of killing patients.
I know. Can you imagine? I mean, so I mean, in some ways, that's a problem bigger than Hillary. I mean, and it shows like how we conceive our foreign policy, how we conceive of leadership. You know, it doesn't really make very much sense. But yeah, I would say a lack of experience in executing murderous policies might be a good start, you know, for a qualification for someone I'd like to see as president. In fact, I've been saying and thinking that for a while, but then actually a couple weeks ago there was a clickhole story along similar lines where it said Bernie Sanders just doesn't have the experience and chops to oust democratically elected leaders, you know, as like critics say or something. You know, and it's like, that's exactly right. I mean, you know, that what do we mean when we say experience, and why do we value experience that is really about a career devoted to things that we really don't agree with? And then on the other side, I'd also say experience is really not limited to Hillary. There are actually lots of people who have been in public life for quite a while, and Bernie Sanders is one of them. I mean, he's been in the Senate for quite a long time, and as mayor of Burlington, he has executive experience. He's run things. You know, he's enacted policy. Just the other day, I was learning more about housing policy, and he executed one of the few successful community land trusts in the country, which really has greatly eased the issue of affordable housing for folks who live in Burlington, Vermont to this day. And that was decades ago.
Yeah, in fact, I believe it was one of the first, so that it became a model for others.
That's right. That's exactly right. It was one of the first.
Yeah. So is there anything else you'd like to say in closing about this book and your experience of bringing together all these left feminists who have criticized the false choices, the faux feminism of Hillary Rodham Clinton?
Well, I think the most important thing to say is that of course, I would love to see Hillary Clinton be defeated in the Democratic primary by her much more progressive and feminist opponent. But I would also, beyond that, I would really like to see a robust left-wing, anti-war, socialist, anti-racist feminism live on, I'm very confident that our kind of feminism is going to outlast Hillary Clinton, but I would like to see it actually defeat the forces that created her in the first place.
Well, Liza Featherstone, thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice about these really important issues in such depth.
Thank you so much.
Liza Featherstone. Featherstone teaches journalism at NYU and Columbia and writes for The Nation and Slate. False Choices will be published in June by Verso Press, but you can find excerpts online by going to writersvoice.net. Rutgers University historian Donna Murch is a contributor to False Choices. Her essay, The Clintons' War on Drugs, When Black Lives Didn't Matter, explores the origins of the Democratic Party's turn to the right, exemplified by the Clintons both in Arkansas and in the White House, and the policy of mass incarceration they did so much to accelerate. Donna Murch spoke with me for nearly an hour in a wide-ranging interview that covered not only mass incarceration and its impact on communities of color, but also why older black voters are supporting Hillary Clinton in large numbers, especially older black women. and why younger black voters are going overwhelmingly for Senator Bernie Sanders. She also discusses the new anti-racist coalition that Sanders' campaign is helping to bring together. You can find that extended interview at writersvoice.net, but we excerpt that interview for you here today. Donna Murch, welcome to Writer's Voice.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Your article, which was first published in the New Republic and is now a contribution to False Choices, the Faux Feminism of Hillary Rodham Clinton, it's titled The Clinton's War on Drugs, and you make that a plural. There are those who say we cannot blame Hillary Clinton for policies that were carried out under her husband's administration. So I just wonder if you could, right at the start, tackle a little bit of that issue. How do you see this as something that the responsibility for can be laid at her feet as well as her husband's?
The reason I chose to call it the Clinton's War on Drugs is that in many ways as a first lady, Hillary Rodham Clinton had an unprecedented involvement in all aspects of policy. In fact, when she ran for senator, that was one of her major points of emphasis, that her political experience came as first lady. So I think that that's been core to her own political strategy from the very beginning prior to her presidential run, but going all the way back to her campaign for senator for New York. So she's used repeatedly this phrase, strength and experience. And so she talked about, you know, her involvement in healthcare reform and criminal justice legislation. And of course, as we've seen from the video clips, she actively came out and campaigned for the crime bill in 1994. She made statements about the war on gangs, referring to youth as super predators. So she was very much an activist first lady who saw herself as a policymaker. And I think that you can't have it both ways. You can't both claim the experience in policymaking as being in the White House while your husband was president, and then say, I don't have responsibility for the legislation that was passed during that period.
So you begin your article referring to an incident that happened in August of 2015 on the campaign trail in New Hampshire. Tell us what happened and what Hillary's response was to that and why you found that response so telling.
There was this remarkable event that happened in New Hampshire where you had Black Lives Matter protesters, rank and file members, come and confront Hillary Clinton on the campaign trail. And Danya Yancey approached Hillary Clinton and said, "You and your family have been personally and politically responsible for policies that have caused health and human service disasters in impoverished communities of color throughout the domestic and international war on drugs that you champion as First Lady, Senator, and Secretary of State. So I want to know how you feel about your role in the violence and how you plan to reverse it." And one of the fascinating things about this confrontation is that Yancey and the other Black Lives Matter protesters use the language of personal responsibility. Doesn't your family have personal responsibility for their impact on the African American community? And what was so striking about that is that the Welfare to Work Reform Act in 1996, the Personal Responsibility Work Act, had that language contained within it. And I thought this was a very powerful and symbolic way of taking the racialized and punishing discourse of personal responsibility, inverting it, and then applying it to the Clintons themselves. So she was also making the argument that Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton should be seen as a team. And so she talked about these in terms of family policies. So this was bringing together a criticism of the importance of the Clintons to mass incarceration with the effects of the really the elimination of welfare as we knew it in 1996.
Yeah, I want to get to what the impact of those policies were. But before that, you know, after that, Clinton met privately with Black Lives Matter activists, and there was a long discussion that ensued. I wonder if you could comment a little bit on that. I mean, there were those who said that, you know, she was really listening to them.
Well, I watched that footage over and over again as I was working on my article, and I think through a portion of it, she was listening. I mean, it had that quality of the way that presidential candidates listen. Listening, I think, is more of a performance than an action. But one thing that was clear is that there was a rising sense of impatience on the part of Secretary of State Clinton, and at one point, she said to them, "It's your job to tell me. It's not enough to protest, that you have to figure out what kinds of demands you want to make." And I think that that was fair enough. But again, it inverted relationships of responsibility. So she was placing responsibility on these young protesters, many of whom may not even have been alive during the passage of the crime bill. For them, rather than, you know, expressing her own platform for how to undo mass incarceration, how to undo the war on drugs. And I think that that's her responsibility as a presidential candidate.
She also said something about how she didn't believe that you could really change people's, you know, racist ideas, and that the only change that you could make would be in the policy area.
Yeah, well, I think that there are ways in which the Clintons, both of them, are really quite brilliant politicians. And they've been able to build very strong networks and patronage networks, including those in the African-American community. However, if you go back and you reconstruct the history of the Clintons' rise to power, it's very clear that they emerge out of a moment in American politics after this massive defeat of the Democratic Party by Ronald Reagan in 1984, where 49 states are vote Republican, and the only state to go Democratic was Walter Mondale's home state of Minnesota. So the Clintons, really, their vision of politics grows out of this backlash and fear about the Democratic Party's irrelevance. And at the center of this was an anxiety about the loss of white voters, especially white working class voters, but really white voters. And so the Clintons become part of the Democratic Leadership Council, and they make direct and veiled appeals to white populations in a moment where the country is moving right. So it doesn't surprise me that Hillary Clinton would say you can't change people's minds, because to put it bluntly, I think that the Clintons for many years have been able to pander to racist ideas while still building patronage networks among African Americans, which is a testimony to what sophisticated politicians they are, and also cynical.
So, in fact, you're saying that they've used racialized politics, what people refer to as dog whistle politics, to, on the one hand, pander to white voters, and on the other hand, pretend as if they're not doing that. You know, Bill Clinton was, what, the first black president?
That's right. Toni Morrison used that title in a piece that she wrote. And it's important to note that she wasn't literally calling him the first black president. It was reported speech of things that she was hearing said tongue-in-cheek in Washington, D.C. And it referred to that the kind of backlash that Bill Clinton faced, you know, the investigation into his sexual impropriety, the intense focus on his physical body, that this replicated forms of racism that African Americans themselves had been exposed to. But it also had another meaning, which is that the Clintons were brilliant at manipulating the racial symbolic. So on the one hand, they really outflank the Republican Party from the right. And they do this through dog whistle politics, through tough stances on crime that we can talk about in more detail, from opposition to welfare, and appropriating some of that very hardline rhetoric of the Reagan and Bush eras. So I think that they did this while at the same time incorporating black people into the inner circle. You know, they opened up as the national outreach director for the Bernie Sanders campaign, African-American outreach director. He pointed out that the Clintons opened up political consulting to African-Americans. So they threw a lot of bones to black political elites, and they engage in the racial symbolic. Bill Clinton went on the Arsenio Hall show, put on a pair of black Ray-Bans, and played the saxophone. Now, what I think is important to note about that is its historical context. This is after 12 years of relentless assault under Reagan and Bush, of the constant use of racially coded terms like the welfare queen and the brutality of the Reagan era. So simply to have a president, in particular a white Southern president, feel comfortable with black people, I think that we forget how bad the 1980s were. So even having kind of social intercourse, Vernon Jordan was one of the Clintons' best friends, seeing black people in the Oval Office, seeing them as an integral part of the inner circle. Historian Clarence Lussain has called this black faces in high places. So the politics of appointment and consulting among black elites was very important, combined with a deep knowledge of popular culture. So they can engage the racial symbolic, which made them appear to be very intimate and friendly with African Americans, but to support policy, particularly punishment and mass incarceration, what we would call carceral policies, and anti-redistributive, anti-welfare policies that had a devastating effect on black, poor, and working class people, as well as all poor and working class people.
Now let's talk about the 1994 crime bill. Actually, there was an op-ed in the New York Times today by a number of writers.
Let me give you their names.
Yeah.
By Vesla Weaver, Jalili Kohler Hausman, and Elizabeth Kai Hinton.
Yes, in which they also take this up, in which they talk about how the Clintons have said that it was black people themselves who advocated for that 1994 crime bill. First, tell us a little bit about what the crime bill accomplished, if we can use that term, and why there was opposition to it, and what kind of opposition there was.
So the Notorious Crime Bill, as it was called, its official title was the Violent Crime and Control and Law Enforcement Act. And essentially what it was a federal mandatory minimum law, but it contained many things. It was a federal three strikes bill that established a $30.2 billion crime trust fund to allocate monies for state and municipal police and prison expansion. So it was vastly expanding the amount of money the federal government was giving both for police and for prisons. It also helped to accelerate punitive policies at the local level. So the statistic that we often cite when talking about the Clinton's crime bill was that under the two terms of Bill Clinton's presidency, 600,000 people were put in prison. Now, the majority of those were put in prison at the state level. And of course, we can't hold the president responsible for state level incarceration. But what I would argue is that the kind of climate that was created, and this is true throughout the wars on crime and drugs, they really, like Nixon's declaration of the first war on drugs, these were executive-sponsored policies where they were top-down policies that came and then flowed down into different portions of government. So the kind of extreme punitive rhetoric symbolized by the embrace of the death penalty, because another important part of the Violent Crime and Control Act is that it added 60 new different offenses, including nonviolent offenses, drug trafficking offenses, to federal law. And a number of people, I think 99 people were killed, were given the federal death penalty under the Clintons. So this was just a massive push forward for the mass incarceration state. And there's something else that I'd like to respond to. One of the criticisms that I got from my article was that the Clintons did not invent mass incarceration. And I would say that is absolutely true. The origins of mass incarceration lie in the mid-1970s, and they have earlier precedents that there's a strong bipartisan element. But this is what I would say, is that like many state policies, mass incarceration was a process. It didn't just start one day. And if you look at it as a process, the most extreme acceleration in terms of number and punishment actually took place under a Democratic president. So I want to stress that mass incarceration was a process, and also the federalization of the war on gangs and the federalization of particularly the use of conspiracy and a whole kind of setting up these networks for the collaboration between municipal, state, and federal law enforcement under the Clinton era really helps to explain the huge numbers of people that we see in prison. It wasn't new, but it was an acceleration of degree that was quite profound.
In fact, you say that under Bill Clinton, more people were incarcerated than under any other president before him.
That's right. Absolutely. More people were sent to prison at the state and federal level than under any of the notorious Republican drug warriors.
And what was the impact on black communities of this?
Oh, gosh. The impact is just devastating. I mean, I think we have yet to fully even reckon with its impact. There are people that have likened it to genocide, understood in the context of massive loss of family, of whole neighborhoods. Heather Thompson has written about million-dollar blocks where whole portions of blocks have been incarcerated, and that cost of incarceration per year is over $1 million a year. I can tell a short little story about that from my research, which really struck me. When I first started researching my new book on crack and the war on drugs, I was doing interviews in Oakland, which is home of the Black Panther Party. And Oakland has always been for me a very special place because of its real political vibrancy. It's such an important place for all kinds of radical politics, queer, black power, anti-capitalist, a variety of different types of radical politics. And I was interviewing one of the activists from the 1960s, and she told me about an event that happened in 2006 after Ron Dellums became mayor of Oakland. And Ron Dellums called in all of his old lieutenants, all these different political constituencies in Oakland. And they asked each group what they wanted. So you had business people, you had black city council people, you had some of the unions present, but they also invited a group of youth activists who were roughly late junior high, early high school, 14, 15 years old, and they asked them what they wanted. And they said that they wanted grief centers. And the adults in the room were really dumbfounded, and they asked them what they meant. And they said, well, you know, many of us have been raised by our grandparents. Large numbers of our parents have been incarcerated. Some have experienced addiction. And now our grandparents are passing. And we, before we could even begin to talk about what we want, we need a way to mourn. And I thought, I listened to that, I thought about that for years afterwards, that a whole generation of people really were denied their parents. So when we talk about 600,000 people being sent to prison, and that's only including prisons, not jails, which have, you know, an even larger percentage. So I think that it has been devastating at the most intimate level. You know, I think the separation between parent and child is probably the most important experience, part of the human experience. You know, Gil Scott-Heron has this song, "Who'll Pay Reparations on My Soul?" And when I think about that family separation, that to me is most serious. But of course, there are many different aspects of things we can talk about. You know, in many ways, people are being stripped of legal citizenship, stripped of the right to vote, stripped of economic citizenship, stripped of the right to work in the legal economy. Because essentially, to have a felony conviction means that you can no longer work in the legal economy. It's very, very difficult. And of course, the public health crisis of prisons, you know, hepatitis B, hepatitis C, all different kinds of communicable diseases and HIV, the rates for infection are much, much higher. So being sentenced to prison has all these different implications, both of the most personal, but also public health ramifications.
Donna Murch teaches at Rutgers University. Her work centers on issues of mass incarceration and the history of black social movements. Her essay, "The Clintons' War on Drugs, When Black Lives Didn't Matter," is included in the collection False Choices, The Faux Feminism of Hillary Rodham Clinton. Don't miss our extended interview with Donna Murch. It's at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.